Hello and welcome to The Conversation with me, Amanda Decadney. This series of The Conversation is brought to you by VS Voices, another fantastic podcast I host, which highlights trailblazing women from around the world to celebrate the multifaceted nature of the female experience. You can listen to Voices on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. On this week's episode, I'm speaking to actress Jamie Lee Curtis about the beautiful benefits of living in recovery.
But I have a question.
Yes.
We're friends, but how many times have we ever been in each other's physical presence?
Never.
That's my point. That's the miracle here, is the intimacy that you and I have shared, both just interpersonally between you and me, in a group setting with people in recovery and people that we share commonality with, sisterhoods. We've never been physically in the same space, and yet you are a deep well of friendship for me. And that's the blessing of the pandemic.
It is indeed. Thank you for acknowledging our really unique and special connection, and also for explaining that it's true. We have never been physically in the same room, but it just goes to show that relationships that are built on vulnerability and honesty and trust
And truth.
Yes.
Brutal, you know, as Elvis Costello referred to it, the deep, dark, truthful mirror.
Yes, that is absolutely true. We do share that with our fellow sisters. And it is certainly the lifeline that keeps me afloat on a daily basis, as I know it is the lifeline for you too. So I want to talk to you about recovery because it's what we share, and you have such an incredible recovery story, in my opinion. I mean, look, on the one hand, you're just like the rest of us. And on the other, I'm just like the rest of us because we're just trying to, you know, stay sober a day at a time here. And on the other hand, you know, we still have the cumulative days of long-term sobriety that have taught so much and brought so much and given such an incredible perspective. So I want to focus our interview on recovery.
Yeah.
And for people who maybe don't know about recovery and don't know what it looks like and don't know what their options are, but I'd like to know why you chose to publicly discuss your recovery, because I have always found that an interesting choice and one that I'm grateful for, because I know people can find you in public. I know that you are a beacon of recovery just because you have been vulnerable enough to let people know that this is what you do. So why did you choose to publicly discuss your recovery?
So it was never my intention. I got sober privately. I got sober in public rooms of recovery. I did not go to rehab. I did not have a celebrity sober trainer. I did not go to celebrity meetings. I walked into recovery rooms, you know, and exposed my truth, which is that I was an addict and an alcoholic, a terrible, shameful secret that I had carried for a long time. And I was sober in public rooms of recovery for a period of time, a couple of years. And it was never my intention. And in fact, quite the opposite. It was my fear that I would be found out in public rooms of recovery. And I was very nervous that it would adversely affect my professional life. And, you know, I'm a famous person walking into a public room of recovery and people talk. And so I was aware that people had been outed and I was worried about it. But nonetheless, a couple years went by, I was sober, and my life got so much better because the secret was out, meaning my addiction secret internally came out. I admitted I was powerless over drugs and alcohol. And I'd found so much recovery in the rooms that I write books for children, and I was doing a book. I was doing a magazine. I believe it was Red Book. It was a woman's magazine. I was doing the cover story. My daughter, Annie, was sitting at the table with me. I'm talking to a wonderful journalist, and I'm telling about how great everything is. And,
yeah.
You know, how Annie and I are getting along really well, and work is going well, and this and that and the other thing. And she said, well, what do you attribute that to? She wasn't fishing. She wasn't.
Yeah, and you had to be honest. It would have been dishonest to not say why.
But I did have that moment, Amanda, where I looked over at Annie. I kind of looked at this woman. I looked around the room I was in, and I thought, you know, do I, don't I? And then I looked at her and I said, I think the reason everything is going so well is because I've been sober for the last 2 years. Now, to her credit, she's a journalist. This is a story that I have now told.
Yeah.
And I saw her kind of going, oh, wow, here's a story.
Yeah. How do I approach this?
Well, and I knew I could, it was almost like Roger Rabbit eyes, like, whoa, like, wow, okay, now. And I simply said, she said, oh, well, let's talk about that. Tell me. And I said, no, I'm not going to talk about it. I didn't tell you it to talk about it. I told you it because that's the result of it.
Yes.
That my life is better. And I chose that moment and told that truth at that moment. Since then, it has now come up in conversation, and I am open about it. And the more open I am, the more comfortable I am talking about it. And as soon as I sort of let that cat out of the bag, then I found it just much easier to talk about it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, and there's a very important thing to also add. When I was wrestling with my addiction, and I mean wrestling with it on a daily basis, there was a magazine article written by a man, a writer named Tom Chiarella, you know, a terrific writer, who had written an article in Esquire magazine that was called Vicodin, My Vicodin. And it was his telling of his experience as a Vicodin addict and the writing of that article. He was outing himself publicly so that he could no longer get his doctor to give them to him. And that article, which literally opened with, I can't tell you where my children's birth certificates are. I can't tell you where my marriage license is, but I can tell you where every single Vicodin is hidden in my house. And that moment, I had goosebumps on both arms.
Was that your drug of choice?
Yes, I was a Vicodin opiate addict. And that moment, Amanda, I realized, A, that I wasn't the only one who had hidden them all over the house, but more importantly, that another human being had the courage to talk about it. And I reached out to him. I found him. I communicated with him. I'm 24 years sober next year, 24 next year. And I call him on my sobriety day and I tell him he is directly responsible with my being sober.
That's beautiful. I got sober because a guy I was dating who was a heroin addict got sober and I wanted to check that he was going to his meetings. So I got sober. That makes sense. That would totally be Amanda's story, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and you know, like whatever gets us into the rooms, right? But I am curious, do you think we're born alcoholics or do you think it's part nature and part nurture?
Well, I'm not a doctor, although I can pretend
just
to
be your opinion.
Yes, no, I'm just saying, I like to qualify, I'm not a doctor. I am the product of many generations of alcoholism and drug addiction.
I read somewhere that you freebased with your dad, which I was which I thought was interesting.
I did. I am the product of family of addicts and alcoholics.
What about your mom? Was she
an addict? My mother was a beautiful woman, but she was an alcoholic. Her mother was an alcoholic. And I will tell you this, it shocks me every time. My grandmother was married to her second husband, and they lived in an apartment in Hollywood. And I remember as a child, we would go visit. And my grandmother was bedridden. And I remember walking into her room, and I would see stars. And the reason I saw stars, Amanda, is because she was in a little twin bed, and they kept a candle burning next to her bed 24/7 so she could light her cigarettes, because they didn't want her to have matches in the bed. Wow. And her bed had little burn holes because it was a polyester blanket. But the reason why I saw stars is because there was no oxygen in the room, because the candle sucked it all up. And I remember saying to my mother years later, you know, Mom, you shouldn't smoke, because Grandma had a stroke and smoking causes strokes. And she looked at me and she said, oh, sweetheart, Grandma didn't have a stroke. And I said, well, what are you talking about? Why was she bedridden with a commode next to the bed? Well, what are you talking about? What was wrong with her? And she said she was alcoholic. And honestly, Amanda, I didn't know that that's what alcoholism did to you.
And that's where it could take you. Now, interestingly enough, if that was your concept of alcoholism, was it hard for you to identify your own alcoholism because your bottom did not look like your grandmother's, for example, or your concept of alcoholism?
My concept of alcoholism, you're right. My whole bottom was not, I like to refer to myself, as you know, as an Everest bottom, a very high bottom. I got sober, very famous, very successful, financially stable. My marriage was intact. My children were with me.
But you were emotionally and spiritually bankrupt.
Oh, I'm saying that my bottom was very high. I did not lose my job, my family, the way many, many people do who suffer from alcoholism and addiction. But internally, I felt like shit. I felt fraudulent and horrible. And for me, alcoholism, and it goes back to my mom a little bit, you know, there's an invisible line in a glass, if you're an alcoholic, which is when someone's pouring you wine and they're pouring it, you go, okay, no, that's fine.
We don't do that.
No, but the line says, alcoholic, I'm not an alcoholic. So my mother would go to dinners, or we were at an award show, and the people would come around with the wine, and I would watch them pour it into her glass, and then she would go, oh, no. That's plenty, which said to everyone, oh, no, I'm not an alcoholic because I'm only getting that much wine.
Those are the tricks we play on ourselves, right?
What people didn't notice is that 10 minutes later, that same waiter would come around and I would watch my mom go like this.
Yeah, more.
But not more, meaning more.
The same small amount.
Fine. Same amount. And that control is where I really saw alcoholism, the dependency on the alcohol, and then the control of what it looked like to other people.
Did you learn that from her?
Of course. Don't we learn from our mothers? Don't we learn that trick? And what it taught me was that what it looked like to other people was as important, because if other people call you an alcoholic, if other people talk about it, that then becomes something bigger. You can't control that.
So what was the moment that you realized that you were in fact an alcoholic, just like your grandmother and your mother? What was that moment? Can you take me back to that time?
A little different than addiction, pills, opiates. Alcohol I quit drinking twice, cold turkey, just bad hangovers, just a feeling of the accumulation of bottles, the sound of bottles. For some reason, twice prior to getting sober, I quit drinking.
That was not your drug of choice then?
It wasn't my original drug of choice.
When I say addict, I mean, or alcohol. When I say alcoholic, I also mean under the, that includes the umbrella of addiction, at least for me, because for me, and everyone defines it differently, I guess, but I appreciate you clarifying what it was for you.
So what happened is I didn't drink, but I would smoke a little pot here or there. And then I had some plastic surgery and they gave me Vicodin. And I had never had Vicodin, or I had never remembered Vicodin. But for anybody who has become now an opiate addict, you know what I'm talking about. There's the warm bath of opiates. It's like that feeling when you sink yourself into a warm bath. You get that sensory feeling from the tips of your toes as it moves up your body as you sink into the warmth. That feeling became something I chased for 10 years. Now, the good news is I'm here. The good news is that they were not available on the internet when I got sober, before I got sober. Had they been available on the internet, I'd be dead. I would steal them. I would manipulate doctors to get them. I am a great person.
You're also a really good actress, so I bet anybody would believe you.
But I'm also a champion for earthquake preparedness. Because of that, I also manipulated doctors to get earthquake kit things, antibiotics, sleeping pills, anxiety pills, and painkillers.
Oh my God. But Wait a second. Jamie, you're telling me that in your earthquake prepared kits, you worked out how to get these pills for sleeping for
Yes. Wow. Yes.
Oh my God. That's a new Jamie story. I don't know. And I love this.
Okay. But I not only get one kit, I have four cars and I have three houses. So then I would do times seven, because when I say I'm going to make an earthquake kit for all of the family cars and the garage and up underneath our bed.
Oh no, you've got to do it properly.
So what I realized was over the years, I also would steal them. And I've talked about this before. I have made restitution to every single person who I ever went into their medicine chest and took opiates out of their medicine chest. I have gone back to those people. I have apologized. I have financially said, I want to pay for the prescription that I think. Like, this was what addicts do. Yeah. I was an opiate addict. Now, I'm 24 years sober. I don't do that anymore. I don't open people's medicine chests without asking for if can I get in there to get an Advil. That was where my addiction took me. That's how low. I still was me. I still was charming and wonderful. And yet that's where my addiction took me. That is the absolute God's truth. But it's more important that I refer to myself as a junkie, just like any junkie on the street, because that's what I did to get the drugs.
I hear you. And I think it's really important to share this part of the recovery journey, because we're often told to look for the similarities in feelings, not similarities in details. And yet, if my association of what it meant to be an alcoholic or an addict was definitely a lot more extreme than how it looked for me. And so I thought, for sure, I'm not an alcoholic or an addict, because I've got friends who are like sticking a needle in their arm, or, sticking a needle in their neck, or whatever it was, And I was like, I don't do that. I take pills and I drink and I do blow and I black out and I do things I don't remember. And I have behavioral things that are really like not okay. I'm dishonest and all those things. But it took me a while to realize, oh no, just because mine doesn't look like other people's, it doesn't mean I don't have this thing too. And I remember feeling so relieved when I remember sitting and listening to someone else's story and the details were different, but the feelings were the same. And I thought, oh my God, what if I have this too? And then accepting that I had it freed me so much because that gave me hope. So I'm wondering what that moment was for you where you identified.
As I said, I got sober in February. The January Esquire article, Vicodin, My Vicodin, by Tom Chiarella, I read in January. So there were three things that happened. I read that article. My sister had been living with me. My sister is an actress, and she had injured herself in a play and was given Vicodin, and she never took any of it because she didn't like opiates. And I remember when she arrived to stay in our guest room for a couple months, I remember she said, I had this rib injury from this play, and they gave me Vicodin, but I don't like it. And I knew it was in her suitcase. And her suitcase was in our guest room, you know, in the back of the closet. And when she would go out during the day, I would go into her suitcase and found that bottle of Vicodin. And over the course of her stay, I took it all.
As we do.
As we do. And I knew when she was moving out that she would find that I had done so. And I wrote her a letter. And I said, I'm so very embarrassed that I stole your Vicodin. I have a bit of a problem with it. So when she came home that night, she, who has been an Al-Anon for a long time, said to me, I love you. You're an addict. I won't watch you die. So that was two. And then the third thing was a mutual friend of ours. I went to her because I thought she was sober because she had gone to rehab. And she had also had a Vicodin addiction, opiate addiction. And I went to her, and at the time she wasn't sober. And so she acknowledged she too had an access to it. And all of a sudden now, for the first time in my life, I was going to have an access to them, like an open access.
Yeah.
There was a doctor who would write you script. And I left her house and I went to sleep. And the next morning I woke up and I realized, Amanda, that either I was going to die and she was going to be at my funeral, hugging my children with blood on her hands, my blood, or she was going to die and I would be at her funeral, hugging her children with her blood on my hands.
What a powerful moment.
And I called her. That's that moment of clarity.
Yeah.
I called her. I said, I came to you for help and you gave me drugs.
Wow.
I'm going to get sober. And I called a friend in recovery, a man, and I said, I would like to go to a recovery meeting, but I'm afraid to go by myself. And he called another woman who's an actress, and she met me at a meeting, and I've been sober since that day.
If you love the conversation, then I wanted to tell you about another podcast I host called VS Voices. The VS Voices podcast provides a platform for women to speak their diverse truths, share personal stories, and advance discussions of issues that are important to them. You can listen to Voices on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. What a beautiful story. As we know, the real magic starts the day that we choose to live and we choose our lives. And for me, that was the day that I chose to get sober. And what I want to talk about is your life since you've been sober, because that's where the real game-changing stuff has happened for me and I know for you. So what surprised you the most about sobriety when you first got sober? What was it that, I guess, what was it that kept you interested and kept you engaged? Because it has to be better than it was. Otherwise, why would we keep doing it? Do you remember the beginning where you were like, huh?
Community. I'm a product of 13 marriages. My parents and my stepfather, between the three of them, there are 13 marriages.
Oh my gosh.
And I have wanted community my whole life. And I've always felt outside of community. I didn't have a big family. I didn't have a big close family. I had acrimonious family. I had siblings I didn't know. My elder sister, who was my best friend, but she and I were kind of, we were separated at one point. We're very different. I've always wanted community. And what I was shocked was how quickly I felt more intimate with a group of strangers than I ever have with people who I consider my closest friends in the world. And I know that's a terrible thing to say about my friends, but that's just the truth. There is a stripping away of the varnish of relationships, a complete stripping of it. And we expose an essential truth of who we are. We have a phrase, as you know, in recovery, when I'm looking in the mirror, the deep, dark, truthful mirror. Thank you, Elvis Costello. When I'm looking in the mirror, I'm looking at the problem.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at the solution to the problem. So I am the problem. It's not my mother. It's not my father. It's not my husband. It's not my sister. It's not my friend. It's me. And as soon as I realized that I was the problem and all of these other people leaned in saying, I'm just like you, that changed my life and is part of the reason that I feel as I do for you, even though you and I have never physically touched each other in a hug, in a handhold, in a...
But man, have we shared hugs and handholds and support in this profound way that comes from our community. And you're absolutely right. That is what kept me engaged as well. And the lack of judgment. Yeah. I felt so relieved that I could finally, you know, be who I was, whoever it was, whatever version of myself that was newly sober, and not be judged. It was the only place in the world I'd ever experienced that. I had felt so judged and criticized, you know, growing up publicly as well. I had felt like, oh, I need to present a certain version of myself and I'm getting shamed for these things that I've done. And to be able to be in rooms with other people who go, oh, no, I did that too. Or like, you know, oh, I know how you feel. It was like coming home. Yeah. I would imagine I had never felt at home until then. It was my idea of what it felt like to be at home.
Well, to thine own self be true. Once you establish a truth about yourself by acknowledging your issues publicly, what happens is Tom Chiarella, who wrote that article, I felt closer to him than I did to friends of mine because they wouldn't understand the way he understood. There's a story in recovery of the early years of recovery where people were trying to figure it out. And there's this beautiful story where there's a couple guys, men, had started to talk about recovery and started to think of a different approach, but they needed more people. They needed to, you know, increase the membership of sober people. And there was a man who they were sent to go visit, and he was in a drunk tank. And, you know, they visited with this man, and the next day they visited him the next day. And when the next day they were there, the man's wife showed up. The man in the bed looked at the wife and said, honey, these are the fellas I told you about. They're the ones who understand. They understand because they're the same as me. And I'm the same as Tom Chiarella. And I hope that by being open about it, other people can see, oh, I'm just like her.
Because let's not forget that this is a killer disease. We're fortunate enough to have found and stayed in recovery, God willing, a day at a time. But it is a killer disease. Every day there are people who are dying from causes connected to alcoholism and addiction. And I'm under no illusion that without the framework of recovery that I have, that that too could be me. So for you, has recovery given you a framework by which you live by?
It has for me as a person in my daily life. I follow a certain group of tenets that I apply that are self-applied. There's no rule book. I didn't sign a
contract.
Thank God,
because we don't like rules.
No, but I mean, there's no contract, and it is a to thine own self be true tenet, and I apply certain modalities of that tenet. I write gratitude lists every day. I write things I'm concerned about or that are on my mind so that they're not trapped in my head, so that I get them out and share them with other people, so that all of a sudden it's not so scary what I'm worrying about. Then there are other areas that have also shifted my consciousness. So for instance, as you know, you and I are both deeply in respect of Gabor Maté, and his writings have really affected me. In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts was a watershed book for me, understanding addiction. His TED Talks and his lectures are profound about trauma and grief and addiction. And as you know, Mark Nepo, who wrote the beautiful book, The Book of Awakening, which is a daily reflection on some tenet of some religion that he sort of takes and then shapes.
Which you kindly gifted me, and I love, and I also read that on the regular.
Those two also help me because it's not just recovery. I also am looking for a spiritual solution. I wrote the foreword of the 20th anniversary edition of his book because it's been such an important book for me.
I do believe in take what you want and leave the rest. And I have put together a patchwork quilt of recovery tools that is the foundation of my recovery on a daily basis. You know, I want to go back and talk about Gabor Maté's work, because he believes that trauma is the root of all addiction.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with him. I think trauma, there's a capital T trauma, and then there's a lowercase t trauma. And I think the lowercase t trauma is the trauma that most people have had perpetrated on them by even a well-meaning.
Listen, even being born is the first trauma, right?
I was going to say, being human is traumatic. And I think there is an undercurrent of traumatic existence that does point toward a life of addiction. And there's a great, in John Steinbeck, in East of Eden, there's a line that says, one child denied the love he craves, kicks the cat and hides his secret guilt. And that phrase has always stayed with me because we all crave love. We're human. We crave love and attention, primarily from our families, our parents, our siblings, and then our people, our lovers. And that denial of love and affection is the wound that then, I think, causes and exacerbates terrible continuation of wounding. And so I think Gabor is really talking about the giant T of trauma, which there are many of those. But we are human beings. And I mean, ask any soldier's family, they are dealing with trauma on a daily basis. The amount of courage that our armed forces, police officers, fire department personnel talk about trauma on the daily. So I don't pretend that my privileged white girl life in show business land, I'm not trying to win an award of who has more trauma. I believe that
who has
all,
the biggest T.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's not about the biggest T. And there are people who have survived horrific losses I work with Children's Hospital Los Angeles. I've been dedicated to them for 30 years. There's not a story in that hospital that isn't connected to a giant fucking T of trauma, because loss of a child, illness of a child, pain and suffering of a child.
Incomprehensible.
And yet people do it every fucking day.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is, I think there's an undercurrent of it. I think Gabor has absolutely, basically dedicated his life to this exploration. But I think just being human, as you said, is by nature exposing us to trauma. And we are all trying to get through our human lives and make the world better for the people around us and the universe of people, strangers that we'll never know, and work on our own wounded selves. And I do believe that Gabor's really onto something. And yet it isn't just drug addiction and alcoholism. It's life.
It is life. Yeah.
The minute you really think about war, all you have to do is watch Peter Jackson's They Shall Not Grow Old, which is his documentary about World War I.
I've not seen that. I've seen the Beatles doc.
But you look at those faces of those children, those young soldiers, and the fear and the terror that they faced, and then the horrors that they endured during the war and coming back. That's where the term shell shocked came from.
By the way, it's happening in Ukraine. You look at the faces of the kids that are being, you know, that's a whole other thing that
I totally understand, but it scrambles your brain.
100%.
And so I do feel like I want to be very careful that I'm not perpetuating some myth that I've suffered, you know, greatly here. I've only suffered because I'm human, but I have not suffered any near the amount of suffering that so many millions of people have and have endured.
Absolutely. So we have a few more minutes here, and I want to ask you about how you pick the stories that you want to tell, because you work consistently, and the choices that you make, the characters that you pick, the stories that you want to tell, I'm wondering what informs your inclination towards telling somebody's story in a way that you feel, I'm the person that can channel this story, and this is a story that needs to be told.
You know, I don't approach it that way.
Oh, wow. How do you approach it?
I wait. The universe provides. I've gone after a couple stories as a producer that have to do, you know, that I'm going to try to mount as movies or TV shows. But the truth is, that was Rooney going to chase something. The truth is that, I mean, honestly, Amanda, I make horror movies. I'm famous for being in horror movies. So it's hardly something I am choosing out of any direct connection to the material or the character. I happen.
But you say yes to things or no to things. So yeah. Why do you say, you don't say yes to everything. The last film you did.
Everything, Everywhere, All at Once.
That film, more people have asked me, did you see this film? This film is incredible. Like, this film has touched so many people.
I know.
So, you know, you said yes to that for a reason.
Yes. I said yes to it because, A, they came to me and I read it once, didn't understand it, but I understood her. That's my job. My job isn't to understand the movie. My job is to understand the person. And I knew people like Deirdre Bobeirdre, who wield power from behind a desk. We've all been in a post office. We've all been in a civil servant office where you are in their domain. And Deirdre Bobeirdre wields her power in a very specific way, but then she goes home basically alone. And I knew that about her. And as for me, I said yes. But really want to know why I said yes?
Yes.
Because it was shot in Los Angeles. Because the truth is, if that had been shot in Boston, I wouldn't have been in the movie.
Right. Well, it had to work for you and your life at that
time.
I'm
saying that it was, the timing of it was right. I was going to be in Los Angeles. I understood Deirdre. And more importantly, and most importantly, I got to work with Michelle Yeoh, who is a fucking legend. And yeah. So for me, it was a great opportunity to play her girlfriend. I knew it was going to be in Los Angeles. I could drive to work. I could be home with my family. And it was fun. No one, I certainly didn't, and I'm not sure anybody involved with the movie had any real idea of what was going to happen. I don't think, maybe the director, certainly the directors, the Daniels, knew what they were going for, but I didn't really know. I knew it was deeply emotional in a way I wasn't expecting in the performance. Like I was moved many times in the performance. And I remember driving home one day, having done the scene with Michelle in the hot dog universe where they're breaking up, and it was very emotional. And I remember driving home really being very moved by the day's work and thinking, this is the weirdest movie I've ever been in, because I was genuinely having emotion.
Oh, Jamie, I would love to see you play a role that really explored the deeply emotional side of you, because that, I know you for your brilliance and your intellect and your logic and your knowledge and your wisdom, but I also know you for your immense EQ and the depth, the well of emotional capacity that you have. I really want to see you play a role that expands that.
Well, I will tell you this in our closing minutes. I did, and I'm not here promoting a movie. I'm here because I respect you as a journalist and really love how truth-telling you do your work. And you know that I respect you for this.
Thank you.
Even though we have not been collaborators.
Yes.
I just watched you from far going, damn. And I told you, if I had met you when I was a teenager, you would have scared the shit out of me. And I was such a good girl. And you would have been like, you would have been my idol. I would have looked up at you and like, oh my goodness, what was I going to say to you? Oh, what I was going to say is I'm not here to sell a movie. I'm not.
I know.
However, I did just complete the last Halloween movie. And I have played the final girl, Laurie Strode, for 44 years. And talk about a deep emotional well of feelings. This last movie was all of that all the time. It was incredibly moving to be her again in this final role. And it's a brutal emotional ride for her. You get her just thinking things are better, and then the power of her grief and rage is really evident. And so I have recently just recovered from having shot this last Halloween movie. And so I'm looking to do a sitcom, baby. Mommy would like to have some fun. I would like to crack some jokes and fall backwards over a chair and maybe kiss a boy. I mean, that's my, where I'm going is I want to do a sitcom. I want to.
And
have,
if I know you, that will come to you too.
Well, I'm making that one come to me. That's where I'm manifesting my own destiny and not waiting for destiny to come knocking. But I'm more interested right now in maybe having some laughs, because I've had a lot of emotional experiences in the last bit of time. And I could use a good couple laughs.
Well, I look forward to experiencing all of it with you in the future.
And me, you, even if we never meet.
Never. That would be an amazing story. What if we go through our whole lives? We just have this friendship that evolves over different stages of our lives. And I know the intimate parts of your life, and you know the intimate parts of my life. What if we never met?
But I don't know what you smell like.
Oh,
I don't know your cologne. I don't know your fragrance. So I have a sense, but it's the one, I wish there was like a
scratch and sniff.
No, you know, well, thank you. You know what we should do? We should each take a stationery card and spray our cologne and send it to each other.
Oh my God, I'm going to do that.
I'm going to do it too.
I'm going to do it. Right, I'm going to do it.
Because I've been wearing Oscar de la Renta since I was 18 years old. And so
that's
for
a Jamie smell.
It's, and by the way, it's a Jamie smell. And I will tell you that my godchildren are Maggie and Jake Gyllenhaal. And many times I will have gone over to visit their mom when they were little. And I would go over and visit their house and with their mom, Naomi Foner, who's one of my best girlfriends. And when I would leave, they would come home from school and Jake would walk in and say to his mom, "Mom, you smell like Jamie." Because
Jamie had been there.
But I have like, there's a smell that is associated with me because I've been literally wearing it for coming up fucking 40, 50 years. I mean, that's crazy.
That's a long time.
I mean, 40 years.
Send that to me. We're going to do a trade. I'm going to let you go because I want you to be not rushed for your next thing.
Yeah, it's all good. I'm so happy to be here with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I love you.
And I love you. And I'm really happy to be here with you.
Thank
you. God bless you, everybody. Be safe.
See you soon.
Okay. God bless.
Bye. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe. And don't forget that if you love the conversation, then check out VS Voices, which highlights trailblazing women from around the world to celebrate the female experience. You can listen to Voices on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And please don't forget to sign up for my weekly newsletter and follow me on social media at Amanda DeCadney.